When I was outside the door, there were some people from Colorado complaining that Dr. Berry had left the University of Colorado at Boulder, and they were désolé about it because she was, previous to her appointment as assistant secretary, she was the chancellor of the University of Colorado. Dr. Berry tells me the two honors, the two positions she holds most sacred and that she is proudest of is that she is also a professor of history and a professor of law. It is my pleasure to present Dr. Berry.
Thank you very much. I have a speech, and I'll give part of it, and then parts of it, the parts that I think make most sense, and then we can have some questions and answers, if that's all right. I faced the prospect of coming here to talk with some concern, because I thought in terms of what I could say about what women should do in education, or what women's movement should do, or what kind of problems there were, what kind of concern. And then I thought about all the meetings that I've been to before over the years where we talked about exactly the same thing. And then I tried to figure out what I would say that would be different, whether I could say that now we had achieved all these things and now we could just simply celebrate, or whether I could simply go around identifying some of the same problems that you already know about. So I was very concerned about what I might say when I came here. I suppose I could do several things. I could talk about all the things that I'm interested in, that in the issues that the women's movement is confronting. And I could talk about abortion, I guess, or child care, or job opportunities, and social and cultural stereotypes, and I could do that. Or I could talk about power. I could talk about that, because that is a basic issue, and that without power, we can't hope to solve any of the problems that exist. And power, and women who create conflicts which make it impossible for other women to exercise power. I could talk about that. That seems to me to be an important issue. But it's clear that the reason why I was invited here is because I'm Assistant Secretary for Education. And since I was asked to come here because I hold that position, I should talk to you about education and the responsibilities in the administration that I have and how they relate directly to the role of women and how they relate to the agenda of this convention. In serving as Assistant Secretary for Education at ATW, first I'll tell you what I do so then you can know what you can ask me. What I'm supposed to do is to coordinate and generally supervise all the education work that goes on in the Department of Health and Education and Welfare. I am the chief education official in the administration by statute, and I'm supposed to be the principal education spokesperson in the federal government. What that means in practice is that I'm supposed to coordinate the work of the Office of Education, the National Institute for Education, and several smaller programs. Joe Califano sometimes says that my trying to coordinate the smaller agencies with the Office of Education is somewhat like a tail trying to wag a dog, since OE is much larger than all of the other agencies and since it's been in existence for so long. And in that job, I have to work with some very traditional males who have some very traditional views about what women should be doing. That includes the secretary. Work with some other and have some others work for me, who are supposed to work for me at least, who have some very traditional views, and a lot of men who would prefer not to hear the advice I give if they could avoid it and get away with it. I just wanted to make that clear to you, that that's what I'm supposed to be doing. Now, a few weeks ago, I got back from, actually it was 2 weeks ago, I got back from the People's Republic of China, where I was met with the Minister of Education and a number of other officials in China. And in many ways, they have much further to go than we do in this country on the women's issues. But then they were binding women's feet only a generation or so ago, and there's still women walking up and down the street who have had bound feet. But the Chinese do have a saying that goes, women hold up half the sky. And as I told them there, in this country, women hold up more than half the sky, at least according to the census figures. And in every education and in every other aspect of American society, women then deserve to have their fair share of the resources and to have the government pay its fair share of attention to their concerns. So we regard it in my office and in HEW as a legal mandate that we have, as well as a moral obligation to see to it that women do get their fair share of attention and that women do get their fair share of resources and fair share of concern. This is true in athletics. Some of you are very concerned about Title IX enforcement and athletics. I just want to tell you that the people who are in HEW now, Dave Tatel and Cindy Brown, who run the Office of Civil Rights, and people like myself and Leslie Wolf in my office, we do intend to implement and enforce the Title IX requirement. We're concerned about it. We come out of background, most of us, where we have been involved in overseeing what government agencies have done and complaining about what they've been doing. And so we do intend to see to it that Title IX is enforced while we're there, whether it's in athletics or anywhere else where its provisions apply. In vocational education, there's a lot of concern about that in the agenda for this conference, and I know some of you are concerned about it. We just recently managed to rewrite some regulations and to issue some regulations, and the regulations are designed to get rid of the kind of occupational channeling and stereotyping that serves to cripple men as much as it does women, although I must say that I'm more concerned about its crippling women. That's just my concern. What people do with their lives ought to be determined by interest and ability. We believe that. We supported that in the voc ed regulations and not by irrelevant tradition or the fact that most of the people who run vocational education are men. And this was not easy to do. I mean, if any of you know anything about what happened with the vocational education regulations, it was a struggle for us there in the office to make sure that in operating with these very traditional men, we were able to get the kind of language put into the regulations that would provide for representation of women on committees, would provide the kind of language that can be enforced in terms of sex stereotyping and curriculum and the like. And it's going to be a tough struggle to see to it that the regulations are implemented. But the main thing was that we had to get them written and we had to get them out in the way that we wanted to. And it took a lot of time and energy, but we succeeded, I think, in that regard. Finally, we're working in AGW to find answers to in another more complex area. When I think about this area, the area of women in administration, it seems like the struggle for the voc ed regulations was simple. Our work is cut out for us. In some areas of education, the situation is getting a little better. But in administration, over the last 30 years, it's gotten much worse. I know statistics are boring, but they also tell a deadly story sometimes, and so I'd like to share a few of them with you. In 1928, 55% of all elementary school principals were women. By 1968, the figure was 22%, and 5 years later, it was down to 19%, less than one in five. So we've not made progress in that regard since 1928. Matters are getting worse year by year. In 1950, there were six women who were chief state school officers. Right now, there are eight, which is some improvements since 1920, but I don't think that's much after 27 years. And this year, only 1% of the local superintendents of schools are women, and only 3% of the assistant superintendents. Those are very telling statistics. Now, as you might realize, there are a greater number of women in lower-level administrative posts than that, about 26% in 1973, and maybe a few more now. But the median income for a male administrator was $13,000 in the last survey that was done, and the median income for women, or a woman working in a similar situation, was $5,000 less. And we believe that this is absolutely unconscionable in a profession that touches on all young people's lives and in a field that has a direct impact on children's perceptions of what life is all about. I don't think we in the federal government, though, can point a finger at the state people and the local people. We've made some progress, but things there are not what they should be either. The head of the National Institute of Education in my division is a woman, Pat Graham, a distinguished woman academic, and the director of the National Center for Education Statistics is a woman. And the director designate, who we have not appointed yet, of the Museum Services Institute will also be a woman. So we're proud of that, and we've made some progress in that regard. But if you look below that level, you will see an abysmal record. In the Office of Education, for example, there were 49 men at the GS 16, 17, and 18 level. For those of you not in the federal government, that's way up at the high of the civil service level. 5 years ago, and three women. That was 5 years ago. This year, there are 41 men and still just three women. And I just was shocked when I was reviewing the regional reorganization of the education division in HEW to find out that in the regions, if we were to fill those jobs that are coming open at the top levels out there, that it seems like white males are the people who will be eligible for almost all of them. And they're eligible because they have the seniority, and they've been there, and they've shown great leadership potential in the past, and have had the right kinds of jobs. And therefore, if we were just to go by the rules, I mean, the civil service rules are a real problem. Those people would be high up on the list for every one of those jobs. And when I discovered that, I went to the person who's responsible for reorganization in the department, and I said, did you realize this when we were proposing these plans, and what are we going to do about affirmative action for women and for minorities in those jobs out there? You're going to end up with an all-white male leadership structure in the regions. He immediately agreed to take it up, and we now have a group of people working on what we can do about it as we fill these jobs so that we don't end up losing ground instead of gaining ground. But those statistics were shocking, and if we had proceeded to fill all the jobs without taking that into account, we would have had just what we didn't want. And then we'd be somewhere like this trying to explain to people why it happens. Statistics like these would be tragic, and they are tragic. But in education, they're all the more so. And this is because clearly, and more clearly than the rest of society, the factors that keep women out of the management posts are so clearly based in remedial deficiencies. It's a shortage of will and based on a shortage of wisdom rather than a shortage of money. You know, in some fields, men can say that there are not enough qualified women to fill a fair share of administrative jobs. And usually that's true, and we all know why it's true. It's because women were kept out of these fields at entry levels, and they never get a chance to develop the qualifications they need. But in education, that hasn't even really been the case. I mean, the society has always depended on women teachers to educate its children, and even now, two-thirds of all elementary and secondary teachers are female. Women do have the credentials they need to get the supervisory posts. More than half the master's degrees in education go to women. And women are getting an increasing proportion of the doctorates in education and the advanced degrees in education administration and supervision. So there are qualified people there, and they are available, and they are eager to take these jobs. Well, part of the difficulty, it seems, stems from these basic attitudes toward women in authority positions. And I'm never disturbed when I hear that men have said that they would prefer to have male supervisors. I mean, that doesn't bother me. I expect them to say that. But what really bothers me is when I read the data and it indicates that women say that they would prefer to have male supervisors. I mean, that's just mind-blowing. I mean, there was a survey I was just looking at on the way over here that was done of women teachers about whether they would like a male or female principal. And only 1 in 100 wanted to see a woman as a principal. And, of course, one study doesn't prove everything, but I think it's clear that this is a real problem. And sometimes, even when women are in leadership roles, I've noticed another thing. Other women often decide that some male person, who is in fact a deputy or a subordinate or something like that, is in fact the real actor. And they will sort of defer to that person and go around to that person, assuming, like men assume, that that person is really the one that has the authority, even when the person doesn't. I mean, so it's just as if women are their own best enemies in this regard. So this is a problem that has to be resolved and that people should be aware of. The whole idea, too, that, and which is what some of these women said who were asked why they had these attitudes, and they said, well, this kind of leadership is an inappropriate role for a woman, and that a woman can inspire the confidence of her subordinates. And this probably keeps a great number of qualified females from applying for jobs in the first place. And so to the extent that it does represent a first barrier to equity in the profession, but it's only the first of many. And then we all know what another barrier is, too, and that's the old boy network, and we don't seem to have the old girl network worked out as well yet. And probably because in most of the positions where it would do you some good to be in the old girl network and refer somebody else for a job, there's still mostly men there. And so we've got to deal with that. This factor is true even in this administration. When you look at the people who have the jobs, I was interested right after I was appointed. There was an article in the paper about women in the administration and whether the women's movement had any influence in nominating candidates. And the article said that most women felt that they had not had much influence, but they could point to at least one appointment where the women's groups had an influence because they had recommended this person, and they pointed to me. Well, I happen to have known, as a matter of fact, the reason why I was appointed was not because the women's groups recommended me. It was because Wilbur Cohen, who used to be ATW secretary, knew me from the University of Michigan, and he knew the people who were recruiting in ATW, and he called up one of his buddies, who called up one of his buddies, and said, hey, how about Mary Berry? Why don't you see if you can get her to come? So it was not even there that the women's groups, where they had recommended people, that really they saw some success in their efforts. So we still have to work on this old boy network business. We know, too, that in most places, jobs are posted when openings are developed, but sometimes not, and even if they are posted, it's usually a formality. People tell their friends about jobs that they may be interested in, and that's natural, but you need to have more women there to be telling their friends about these jobs. And then when we get the women into these consideration for some of these jobs, we're told that they're not as qualified for leadership. And then we look back and we see that, for example, a man has been a department chairman and where a woman has not had a chance to be a department chairman. And we're not even really sure that these things are indicators of success in an administrative job anyway. I mean, maybe we ought to maintain that you don't have to be a department chairman or whatever it is in order to be a principal. I mean, I'm not really sure that this means that somebody is better able to assume the mantle of leadership. We know all this is nonsense. I do and you do. But we have to show other people. We have to show the fact that a disproportionate number of football coaches make their way to principalships represents a problem, not just for women, but for the whole education system. I mean, who wants, I have nothing against football, I mean, really, but why should we assume that football coaches make the best principals and that's good for everybody, good for the kids, good for the teachers, good for the society? So we have to move away from characterizations of leadership that equate ability with traditionally defined masculinity. I mean, why is it that if you're going to be a principal or a superintendent, you should be a tall person? And that the taller you are, the more likely it is that you will be better at being that. I mean, what kind of an assumption is that? I mean, but we see it happening everywhere around us. I know when I was chancellor at Colorado, I used to have receptions, and I'd stand in line with the people there. And people who didn't know me would come in and they'd pass right by me and go over and shake hands to all kinds of people down the row. And then they'd get to them and they'd say, where's the chancellor? And somebody would say, she's over there. And they'd say, oh, well, okay. And then I'd ask them why they said that. They never said it was because I was black or female. They said, well, you're so short. Yeah. So how do we do all this? How do we turn all this around? First of all, I hope that the conference will pass the agenda item on education and give strong support to it because it addresses a number of these problems. The other thing we do is we disseminate information that we find to try to explode some of these myths. We also, Dave Tatel and Cindy Brown and Leslie Wolf and I, we try to enforce Title IX. And we try to encourage and support and help people like Eleanor Norton over in EEOC in trying to do that. And we also do things like encouraging and doing everything we can to see to it that the Justice Department intervened on the right side in the Bakke case and in other cases where they can have deleterious effects not only on minorities but on women. So we do all that, but we can't stop there. The problem is too great to depend for its solution on negative policy. We've heard a great deal of nonsense about the concept of affirmative action, and I'm sure you have. And some people contend that it's biased and unfair to try to rectify the mistakes of the past. But it's interesting to me that the people who say this are almost never the victims themselves. I mean, they usually, even there, you have very few women claiming that there shouldn't be affirmative action for other women, which is kind of interesting. But the people who say this are usually the people who've not been victims, and they're almost always people who stand to lose, or they think they stand to lose, as we move toward equity. And this is a serious problem, and I would not impugn anyone's motives. But we do need affirmative action programs to bring women into elementary and secondary education administration in every state and every district. And we need those programs and to enforce them at the federal level to get people into some of those jobs where they have some influence on policy and what's going to happen in the country. So we do need to set goals for doing this. And we need to encourage administrators and school boards, and we're doing that, to examine their own attitudes and see why, in the face of the ample number of qualified women teachers, there are so few women administrators. And so we can do that. We can enforce the law, and we will, and we can provide technical assistance, and we will, for training and recruitment efforts, and we will do all of that, and we will follow up on the agenda of this conference if it's passed. And I have every confidence that it will be. Well, that's the end of my speech. It has been passed? Good. I didn't hear. I asked somebody outside, and they didn't tell me. Okay. Well, that's good. Well, we'll follow up on it. We're committed to following up on it in HEW. If you have any questions, I mean, I assume you do. Yes.
My name is Alva Carlin. I am the president of the National Subject Chapter of the National Council of Administrative Women's Education. This last March, we have filed three class action suits with HEW. And we have not heard in one, as in two, and we lost to the third. During the course of the proceedings, Acting Commissioner Valentine said that it is most unlikely that money would ever be withheld from the school because of any violation of Title IX. And so, at least in our region, and this is reported in the New York Times, so at least in our region, we see very little hope of doing anything if this is the public posture that the office takes.
Well, I don't know who Acting Commissioner Valentine is, and this was filed. She said that in her which region here, that in her region they filed some three Title IX complaints. Is that what you said? In March, and that they lost one of them, and that the other two they had not heard, and that in the interim, someone named Valentine.
Acting director
said that maybe he's the regional person, said that in the interim he said that he could not see, or that there would never be a time when HEW would cut off money for Title IX violations. That was the question. First of all, the acting director Valentine, the reason why he's acting director is because he can't speak for the for HEW. Secondly, the enforcement of Title IX and all the civil rights regulations and orders is being withdrawn from the regions and sent to Washington in the reorganization that's taking place, so that Dave Tatel and Cindy and those people down there can have direct control over trying to solve their problems. We have had a huge problem in HEW, as some of you may know, of a backlog of complaints. Since I first started consulting with them in 1972 in the Office of Civil Rights, the backlog has just increased. They never did seem to figure out how to solve some of the complaints that they already had. I mean, it's a quite valid problem. Tatel tells me that what he's doing now is that he will be able to get those complaints resolved, that he has a timetable for speeding up looking at them, and that he's going to move very vigorously in that area, and I expect him to. The other part about cutting off money, as I understand the administration's commitment, and as I understand the secretary's commitment, and mine, and Tatel's, and everybody else's, if people are in violation and they're found in violation, their funds will be cut off. I mean, we don't want to cut off funds from people just for the sake of doing it. I mean, unless we have to, but we've done that. I mean, we've said that we do that in the case of in New York in the desegregation case with the ESO. We just didn't give them any money; they weren't eligible. We did the same thing in Chicago recently. On Title IX cases, we have the same attitude, that if people aren't in compliance, we're perfectly willing to follow the law. There has been an end to the policy of saying that, you know, we're never going to cut off funds, which was a policy before we all came there, as far as I understand. So if I were you, I wouldn't feel that it will not happen. I would think that every effort would be made to get people into compliance, But the people ought to understand, if they don't get in compliance, that there is a very real threat, which makes this different from what happened before. If that changes, I mean, if I should discover that there isn't any real commitment to doing that, I'll be the first to let you know. I won't be there either, but as I understand it now, that is a commitment, and when these are resolved, if people are in violation, it takes time, and God knows it shouldn't take that much time, and there shouldn't be that backlog of complaints, and I have been one of the greatest critics of the Office of Civil Rights for not resolving those complaints over the last few years, but Tatel says that he's got a plan now to get the things resolved and to get them out of there, and so I wouldn't give up yet.
Following up on you?
Well, I would follow up in Washington. I wouldn't follow up with Regional Director Valentine or whoever he is. If you want to write a letter to me, it's really Dave Tatel's responsibility, but if you want to write a letter to him and send me a copy, I will talk to him about it personally, or you can just write to me if you want to. Okay? Yes.
Sort of along the same line, maybe my concern is not so much the money being cut off, but I would like HCW to publicize decisions that they do make. It will help in two ways. One, it will give Title IX people some idea of what the shape of enforcement is going to look like. And then secondly, it does sort of give you a feeling that OCR is alive and well and that they are making the Title IX decisions. And that you don't have to go to the ultimate. But as far as I know now, there is no real official way for us to find out what decisions are being made or have been made in an orderly fashion. Do you have any publication or whatever? I'm going to rely on private leaders' newsletters.
Yeah. Yeah. There was these decisions that are made in individual cases that are done by letter are not required to be published in any particular thing. But at a meeting, I guess a month or so ago, of some women's groups that came to meet with Dave Tatel, and we met with the secretary and other people in the department, Tatel made a commitment that sometime in December that he would begin to make available in a systematic fashion all of the letters and opinions that OCR had issued in individual cases so that people could get guidance, and that he would do it in a form that would be made available to the public. Now, I don't know how. He said that it would be available for anyone in a systematic form. I don't know whether they plan to publish something or to have something systematic which groups can get and then publish the whole thing, I mean, all the letters that are there. But they're not required to do it in the register or anything like that, and that's why they haven't. But he did say, and he did make that commitment, that he would begin to make sure that people had those things available to them. You're quite right, because it gives you guidance about what to do, and you can see what the decisions are elsewhere. Right, and even if Tatel doesn't want to publicize them, and I don't think he should, I mean, I don't think he should take a letter about somebody's individual case, groups can look at those, and if they want to publicize the fact that OCR has made certain decisions, they can do that, and it can be publicized in a general way, so that you're right, it gives the appearance and everybody understands that they're still alive and that they are doing something, which might have a good effect on somebody else's case somewhere. You're right, because so long as people think that OCR isn't going to do anything and that nobody in the federal government is going to do anything, then they're not willing to take steps that they would take otherwise. Yeah. Right. Right. Yes.
Would you talk louder, stand up, or something?
She works in the Department of Health in the state of California, and she's concerned about health. Civil rights. Some more general compliance guidelines. Well, I don't know. I mean, hasn't he been making statements like that?
Not all the way to California.
Okay. So there's a problem with people. I mean, everywhere I go, I tell people that. I was at this big Title IX conference somewhere where I said, you know, the good guys are back in town, or the good women are back in town, and that we were going to enforce Title IX. I've been saying that everywhere. I thought Tatel I'll tell him that the word hasn't gotten out to people or out to California that he's really sincere or what it is he's doing. I'll tell him that. Okay, I'll tell him. Yes. Oh, beautiful. Fantastic. 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 Let's get many, many more, just like that. My goodness. Okay. All right. Yes. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought I... Okay. Well, I'll tell you more about it. Okay. I'm in ATW. And in ATW, Health, Education, and Welfare, there's the education part of ATW, which is called officially the Education Division of ATW. I was appointed to my job by the president. It was a presidential nomination with the advice and consent of the Senate. What I do is report to the secretary of ATW, Joe Califano, and I'm responsible for coordinating and supervising all of the education activities in ATW, as well as coordinating ATW's education activities with those of the other federal agencies in the government.